Okay, should we begin? It's actually a very short mimer this week that I picked out. The point is, this is also part of the Bossi Ligani series that 60 years ago the previous Rebbe passed away and left this 20-chapter Bossi Ligani discourse. And on and 59 years ago, 1951, on the 10th of Shvat, which is the day the previous Rebbe passed away, the Rebbe said the discourse, Bossi Ligani, I've come into my garden, which we explored. The one we explored last week was the one he said after 20 years. Was a very that when he completed the whole, every year he would explain one chapter, and so he came to the end, and so that was the 1970 discourse that we explored last week. However, I'd like to just go back to this, what was happening in 1951, because on the 10th of Shvat, he said the discourse, Bossi Ligani, and then a few days later, he said a discourse which was on the 13th of Shvat. He said a discourse focusing on the second. He said the Rebbe said a discourse focusing on the second group of five. You see, there's four groups of five chapters in the original discourse, the original long discourse of 20. So the second group of five begins with the words Hayoshevet Beganim, the one who sits in the gardens, Chaverim Makshivim Lekolech, the friends are listening to your voice. Hashmi'ini, listen to me. Now, like the words Barti Ligani, I've come into my garden, this is from the Song of Songs. So this second discourse, Hayoshevet Beganim, we've actually got the first page of it, both in Hebrew and in English, of the original discourse by Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak. And the point is that it's exploring, it starts off with this, with a midrash, which we'll come to in a little while when we begin the discourse properly. Which is the one on these words, Hayoshevet Beganim, the one who dwells in the gardens. What the Midrash is basically saying, Midrash Rabbah, on this verse of Song of Songs, is that it's the souls of the Jewish people who are in the gardens. And the Chaverim, and the gardens, are the gardens of the Batei Medrash, the Beit HaMedrash, and the synagogue. In other words, a place where Jewish people gather for a spiritual purpose. That's one interpretation. And the friends who come to hear them are the angels. And it's this sense, the whole theme of this brief discourse that we're going to be exploring, is the power of the individual here in this world. That the fact of being in this world, in fact, gives one the greatest spiritual leverage in all worlds. And there's a sense in which this was the key, one of the key, or maybe the key teachings of the Babach Rebbe. The idea that we here in this world have got this tremendous spiritual strength, and in relation to all levels of existence, that it's us facing the challenges that we face in the physical world, in fact gives us an immense sense of, not just a sense of power, but a tangible power to transform negative into positive. Now, the original discourse of Rabbi Yosef Yitzchok, I'd just like to say a little bit about that first. That means it's the second set of five chapters. We do have over here the beginning of it. And I think maybe if I just take a little bit of this first page, which is on the back of the English, V'hine b'ze yuvan, if you look at the second paragraph here, yeah, on the back of the English. So we're not going to read the first paragraph yet, because that first paragraph is really going to be duplicated in the Rebbe's discourse. But what we're reading here is not. And here we're talking about the idea of transforming negative into positive. V'hine b'ze yuvan, now from this can be understood, Masha Atzea Mishkan, why the planks of the sanctuary, Nikraim b'shem krashim, are called krashim. In Hebrew, keresh means a plank. But there are other words that could have been used. And last week we did discuss this idea a bit. Okomo shekatuv va'asita et ha-krashim la-mishkan, you should make the planks for the mishkan, for the sanctuary, atzei shitim omdim, standing cedar wood. Cedar wood or acacia wood, different words are used to translate this word shitim, which it then explains in the earlier part of this discourse, that the word shitim comes from the word shtut, folly. Folly. So there is a concept of folly, right? It's a well-known phrase or word in Hebrew, shtut. Mata medabesh, shtuyot. Yes, a very common Ivrit phrase. So in chapter 3 and 4 of the earlier part of the discourse, we're now looking at chapter 6, you see, he defines folly. How do you define folly? There is a line of reason which we can depict as, you know, this sort of line on the page, and that's the line of reason. Now, folly is turning away from this line of reason. And the normal kind of folly that we consider is negative folly. And negative folly is a turning which is below the line of reason. So someone behaves in a way which is somehow below the line of reason, and that is folly, which is called shtut diklipa, the folly of the concealment of the divine. And the folly of the concealment of the divine, shtut diklipa, is the folly which is lower than reason, is the kind of folly which leads to negative behavior. In Jewish terms or in any terms. So that's the folly which is lower than the line of reason. And, but at the same time, there's a different dimension of folly. And the other, what would that be? What? Yes, shtut de kedusha, which we can depict like this as a line which is going higher than reason, and that is sacred folly. The idea that there is a folly which is actually sacred, holy. How can you have sacred folly? It means an utter level of dedication which transcends reason, that a person does things which are beyond the call of reason. So it might be some extra concern about something in Torah, in mitzvahs, some extra passion in fulfilling the mitzvah of love of one's fellow. In some sense, going beyond the lines of what one is expected to do in normal terms, and going beyond those lines. And there are a number of terms in the of phrases in the Talmud and in Jewish literature, later Jewish literature, which define this sometimes as self-sacrifice, or sometimes it's called Mishnat Chasidim, the path of the pious, which the Talmud speaks of. So in other words, an extra sort of pietistic level which goes beyond ordinary rationality. Now, it's interesting that when we consider the Hasidic movement as a whole, from the Baal Shem Tov onwards, there's a sense in that it was trying to introduce sacred folly into people's lives. And it was trying to go beyond the simple definition of the mitzvah in order to achieve inspiration and a sense of closeness to the divine, which comes about when a person goes beyond the ordinary rational demand. You see, even in halachic terms, in terms of Jewish law, you can say, well, this is what the person is expected to do. You don't have to do more than that. You go up to this line. So the teaching of the Baal Shem Tov was to take it a little bit further in some sense. It might be an extra hidur mitzvah to be especially careful or strict about some mitzvot. For example, the early Hasidim began worrying about shechita, actually, the method of slaughtering animals. And just around that time, a new kind of process for honing knives was developed. And it made knives which were much sharper than those they'd had previously. And the Hasidim immediately said, that's the kind of knife we're going to use. We're only going to use these new, very sharp knives rather than the old knives. The difference is the way in which they were honed. If you look at the cross section, you can have a thing that's
bevel.
Yeah, that's right. How it's bevel. In fact, somehow or other, I've got a picture of it over here. You can see this one is beveled on one edge. Mm-hmm. That knife is beveled on one edge, whereas this one is beveled on two. So on both sides. So it's it's sharpened on both sides. So that means that this point is actually a sharper point than this one. And so maybe it was thinner than it is in this picture. So they began using that. So in other words, they were going a little bit beyond, and in fact there were arguments about it. You know, other people said, oh, you shouldn't do that, we've always used these old knives, what's wrong with the old knives, we should keep on using the same thing. But the Hasidim said, look, the new knives are sharper, the whole idea of a shechita knife is it should be perfectly sharp, and so if these are sharper, then we should be using them. So with prayer, the whole idea of putting more emphasis into prayer also led to more intense feeling of different kinds. So that's the sacred folly versus the folly of klipa, the negative folly, with the idea that the sacred folly in some way redeems the negative folly by the fact that the person has this higher reach that can redeem the negative dimensions of themselves. Now, this is expressed.
Was the case of Nadav and Avihu a case of sacrifice?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, what you've just focused on is the problem that sacred folly has to be treated in a very delicate way, because what they did was a form of sacred folly, but it was too...
Hello.
Hi, how
Hello.
Are you?
I'm well. This is Gabriel.
Hi.
He is my cousin from Brazil. Just arrived today.
Shalom.
Because of him, we are late.
That's not true.
Thank you for tonight. Shalom, Gabriel.
Shalom.
He speaks Portuguese very well.
Wonderful.
And English, he understands. And Hebrew, he does.
Hi. Nice to meet you.
Hebrew?
You've read a little bit, I think. It doesn't need
No.
Okay, fine. Okay. Please sit down.
Center.
Would you like a drink or something? All right, well, we've been, while waiting for you to come. We've been exploring this idea that there is a line of reason, and then there is folly which goes lower than reason. In other words, doing crazy things which are wrong and damaging and negative. But there is also a form of folly which goes higher than reason, which is sacred folly. And so this is mapped out in the... we're exploring a discourse. See, this is a... for Gabriel's sake, I'll just explain what's... Because these are like texts upon texts. This is a translation of a discourse which is in 20 chapters, which was written or taught by Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson, a rabbi, the 6th Lubavitcher Rebbe, who died in 1950. And before he passed away, he issued this discourse in Hebrew, asking that it should be studied on a particular day, the 10th of Shvat, the Hebrew month, and then he passed away on the 10th of Shvat. So it became his, like, last testimony. So then, the 10th of Shvat the next year, the 7th Lubavitcher Rebbe, the famous Lubavitcher Rebbe of this previous generation, began, taught a discourse about this. And the discourse begins, Bati Legani, I've come into my garden. The whole idea of the world being a garden. Now, that itself is a very interesting concept, because it is quite possible to see the world in a very negative way. The world is negative and the world has lots of problems. And a person can say, how can I cope with this negative world? All I'm going to do is find a little sheltered place for me to live. I'm going to find the most comfortable spot. Maybe it's in São Paulo. Maybe it's in Tel Aviv. Maybe it's in New York. Who knows? And there I'm going to, maybe it's in the woods somewhere in Canada. You know, and there I'm going to carve out a comfortable life for myself. I can't cope with the whole world. The world is in a terrible state. So comes the message, Bati Legani, I've come into my garden. You know what? The world is really a garden. The world is very beautiful. The problem is, things have gone wrong to a certain extent, but they can be put right. So there's a phase of negativity. But in essence, the world is something beautiful. Right? Now that's this Hasidic, optimistic teaching. One way of understanding Hasidic teachings, you know, there are many Jewish teachings, and Hasidism is a particular movement, and one way of defining it is optimism. It's an optimistic movement. It's optimistic on many different levels. So that's the statement, that the world is a garden. So everything is good. You can do the most wonderful things. You don't have to hide away in a comfortable little spot somewhere. You can say, you know what, I feel a responsibility for everything going on around, and everything that I do positive is going to help the whole world achieve its goal. So the world is really a garden. There is a phase of negativity and darkness. Now, how good is your English?
I'm getting
it. Don't be fazed by the phase. Okay. Don't be fazed is F-A-Z-E-D by the phase P-H-A-S-E. The second,
the first phase
means like upset and knocked out by something, you know. So if someone can remain calm, you know, they they drive into I don't know what, you know, some terrible thing happens, but they're not fazed, you know, they're calm. So don't be fazed by the phase, by the period of darkness and gloom. It's a period of darkness and gloom, but the reality is something very beautiful. Don't worry about that. This was our rabbi on Shabbat. This was his quip, his pun.
Don't be fazed by the face.
Yeah, in his explaining of Bhakti Ligani from the pulpit. But then a person could say, you know what? There's such negativity in the world. I'm actually repeating his drasha at the moment. So there is such negativity in the world, even if it's only a phase, it's too much for me to cope with. Right? So then we have another concept. Nitaveh HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Holy One, blessed be He, desires to have a dwelling, liyot lo yitbarach dira b'tachtonim, that he should have a dwelling in the lower world. So in other words, the goal of God is that there should be a garden, that the world should be a garden. It's not just that it was a garden and now it's going through a phase of darkness. The divine goal is that it should be a garden, it should be a beautiful garden. So that is another level of encouragement to the person to do positive things, and in that way to lift up the world. Now, that's one concept. We then come to the idea of how we're going to lift up the world, how we're going to transform negative into positive. So another part of this teaching is the idea that you have a line of reason, and then you have going below the line, doing negative things. But there is also a step of sacred folly, which is going above the line. Now, what sacred folly might be in the life of any individual? It could be, for example, the decision that a person thinks, you know what? What about if I start eating kosher?
Eating kosher?
Yeah.
It is a folly.
Well, you see, in certain, for you know, there are people who live a lifestyle where it's actually very hard not to eat kosher. You know, there are some people, the district where I live, all the shops, you know, basically they're Jewish food shops, you know. And if you walked into a non-Jewish food shop, it would be Muslim or Polish. You know, they would look at you, you know, what are you doing? The owner of the shop, they're virtually no, like, ordinary white Christian shop. You know, like, so they're all something, you know. And so the Jews have their shops and the Poles have their shops and the Muslims have their shops. I mean, there are Muslim shops which many Jews patronize as well, like vegetable shops and so on. But you know, you're locked into a kind of a kosher domain. But there are many people for whom eating kosher is a very big challenge. So, and goes beyond the normal run of life. You know, how do you eat in the evening? You go to a restaurant. Find a kosher restaurant. Well, it depends where you are. In New York, in, you know, in other places, that's, is easy. In this part of London, it's easy. But in other places, it's very difficult. So the step that a person says, you know what, I'm going to start eating kosher, that could be like a step of sacred folly. You know, that's going beyond the norm as far as they are concerned. But it's that ability to go beyond the norm, which is a tremendously powerful thing in a person's life. And the thing about the sacred folly, unraveling that whole discourse, which we're not really exploring at this moment, is that the sacred folly, which goes higher than reason, redeems and transforms the folly which is lower than reason. So there are things that a person does or has done which are plain stupid and really got them into a lot of trouble. However, God is running the world. And it is possible that a person should so redirect their life that what was negative actually becomes positive. And that's an amazing trick in a person's life if they're able to pull it off with the help of God.
50 years you eat non-kosher, and after 50 years you start eating kosher. And you have the best of both worlds.
Well, it could be that, let's imagine a cook who learnt all the most amazing recipes of like world cuisine. And now he starts to eat kosher and to cook kosher, and suddenly he's able to apply this art into a cordon bleu, a kosher cookery system. We actually know someone like that. He's set up a cookery school in Jerusalem in order to create...
Jonathan.
Yes, that's right. Yes, in order to make real cordon bleu kosher cooking, and he's got a school training chefs in this, so everything can be in it. There's a kosher version of it, whatever it is, except I did once know some people who were trying to become more observant, and they began eating kosher, but the it was a couple, and they had a favorite dish called tandoori chicken. and they could not find a kosher version of it. And now you can. Listen, now my life is more advanced. It's you can have, it's the world of Windows 7, obviously... everything is possible, but in those days, long ago, it was probably in the time of Amstrad computer, they weren't able to find, and every woman, in this part of London and in Stamford Hill, we're trying to make tandoori chicken in a kosher form, and each time they would start eating it and say, nah.
How did they know?
Well, that's it. They were beginning to keep kosher. You mean how did the cooks know how to?
No, how did they know that it's...
No, because they ate it. They didn't. They knew what the real thing was supposed to be.
In Israel, you can find it very easily.
Ah, you see? Israeli technology is phenomenal technology. So there is this whole process. And in fact, this is something that we explored last week. Here is a little bit of Hebrew that you have the idea of something being. Now, Shin Kufresh spells the word Sheker, and Sheker is falsehood. But if you rearrange the letters, you get the word keresh, and keresh in the context of what it's being described in the Bible, keresh means a plank of wood, which makes the sanctuary, or the temple. So you can take something which in itself is negative, is false. So this is something false. You can take the falsehood and you can turn it into a plank of the temple, something which is holy. So just by rearranging negative things, they can actually become holy things, which is a very interesting teaching about life, the way in which we can transform different aspects of our lives in order to achieve something spiritual. Now, we now come to this next discourse, which we're going to try and explore together. And is going to take, it's quite a short discourse, so even though it's late, maybe we will be able to get through the whole thing. And so we're going to try and begin the actual Hebrew discourse, but I'll be translating.
Much bigger.
Oh, you've got two. You've also got to. Okay. We've all got to. Okay. But in order for us to get into the discourse, there is a special melody of the discourse. And so we'll start with that melody. Oh, yom, bom, bo, ya, 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 yom. Ha, ya, ram, ba, ram, ba, ya, yom, bo. Yamba, 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 ya, yo, yo. Ha yiram ba ya yiram bam bam. Aho ya yiram ba yam ba ya ya yiram ba ya ya yam. Ha yiram ba ha yiram. Ho ba yam ba yam ba yam ba bam bam. Ha ya yam ba yam bam bam ba yom bam ba yo yam bam bam. Hayoshevet baganim chaverim makshivim lekolech hashmi'ini. Okay, so we're looking over here, but I'm going to be translating. Now this is from the Song of Songs. The Song of Songs is a beautiful poem written by King Solomon, and it looks like a poem about a man and a woman together. But the sages tell us it is actually about God and the Jewish people. So he says, the one, and she is feminine, the one who is sitting in the gardens, friends are listening to your voice. Shh, listen to me. Right? So that's the ordinary context, as it were, of a man saying to a woman, come, people are listening, let me just speak to you. But it's explained on another level. Upirish Rashi, Rashi explains, based on the Midrash, Hayoshevet Beganim, who is sitting in the gardens? It's the Jewish people. HaKadosh Baruch Hu Omer LeKneset Yisrael, God says to the Jewish people, At HaNefutza BaGola, you're scattered in the exile. Ro'a BeGanim Shel Acherim, you have to wander from one garden to another, different people's gardens. However, you then sit down. Where do you sit down? V'yoshevet bebatei knesiot ubatei medrashot. At some point, you gather in a synagogue, in a study house. You do something Jewish. I interpret this discourse that when it says sitting in a synagogue or a study house, it means some Jewish action, whatever that Jewish action is, some kind of expression of Jewish teaching. Chaverim makshivim, friends are listening. Who are the friends? Malachei hasharet, angels, spiritual forces. Sheheim chavarayich b'nei elekim dugmateich, they are your friends. They are spiritual, just like you are spiritual. Ba'im lishmoa kolech, they come to hear your voice. Bevatei knesiot, in these spiritual situations. So there we are, the whole idea of being in a spiritual situation, and the fact that one makes one little step, whatever it is, to change the sheker, which really, it's called sheker, it's called falsehood, but really it's like normalcy. There's a line of being normal. And then there is doing something out of the normal. And it's that going somewhere higher, which might look strange and sometimes can be very problematic. There was a very, very English person who, living in London, who decided he's going to convert to Judaism. And he was a real, like, Englishman in his style. And you would not have, if you saw him, you wouldn't in any way imagine that, you know, he certainly didn't look Jewish in any way. He wasn't Jewish. And then he converted to Judaism. And it took a long time, and so on. And gradually, somehow, he began to look a bit more Jewish. I don't know what, was it the kosher food, or was it this? And one day he came very excited to someone's house. He said, hey, you know what? I was in the street and some people called out to me, dirty Jew. He was so pleased that at last his Jewishness is being recognized. this step of so that concept, you know, or sometimes as people become more observant. People choose a path of more observance, and so they might look completely not Jewish in their, you know, their normal period, and then they become a bit more observant and a bit more, and then someone calls them a dirty Jew, and they're very pleased, they're very happy. That's you know, we made it. That's a tremendous, tremendous level. So, any step of spirituality is something that is regarded as spiritual in this idea that God, the angels, everyone considers this to be a tremendous thing. Now, if we go, so we see, so the Jewish people sitting in these synagogues, v'korin et Shema, v'oskim b'Torah, they say the Shema, they study Torah, they do something Jewish. Chaverim makshivim, these angels listen, and the Midrash says, Ani ufamalia sheli baim lishmo b'kolech, God and his host of angels come to listen to your voice. Now that's one Midrash. V'odita b'midrash rabba, and there's another Midrash. You understand Midrash? Do you know the term? Okay, Midrash is levels of explanations. There's Torah, mm-hmm. right? And then there are many, many levels of explanation. Okay, yeah. So they are called Midrash. It comes from a word meaning, Lidrosh means to seek. So seeking more explanations, more ideas mm-hmm. in this teaching. So another teaching, Chaverim Nikra, the, 1 second.
7.
Yeah, I tell you what, let's miss out the rest of this paragraph. Let's begin at V'hine Baze Yuvan. We're missing out. V'hine Baze Yuvan through this. Sorry, we're reading. I'm reading the wrong page. It's supposed to be this page. It's the reason I got muddled up is because it's saying basically the same thing.
Which page should it be?
It should say I Erev at the top. Ein
Erev.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. It should be Erev at the top. Okay. So so basically the reason why I got muddled up is because it's basically saying the same thing. But then he gives a second explanation. That's what I was looking for. Upirosh. Upirosh Hasheni, that's 6 lines down. You have it, Eli? Vav Pei Yud.
Yeah.
Yeah. Upirosh Hasheni, the second explanation. Hu deganim kai al gan Eden. When it says gardens, it means the Garden of Eden. Va'av sheyesh b'ze kama medrigot. Even though there are many levels of the Garden of Eden, la'em kates, infinitely. That's a very interesting idea. The Garden of Eden is many, many different levels, spiritual levels, beyond this world. Ach b'chlalut nechlekim l'shtei madrigot, but in general, they're divided in two levels. Gan Eden ha-tachton, the lower Garden of Eden, the Gan Eden ha-elyon, and the higher Garden of Eden, which are really dimensions of spiritual realms. V'chaverim makshivim, and who are the friends listening? Hainu hanishamot. These are the souls, shebegan Eden, who are in the Garden of Eden, shenikreim chaverim.
They are gan Eden, tachton or elyon?
Both. It's really both, because they go higher and higher. In fact, when a person passes away, and then there is an anniversary of their yahrzeit, we say, sometimes people say, the neshama, the soul, should have an aliyah, should go higher. Because the idea is, when they pass away, their soul goes to one level of the Garden of Eden, and then the next year, their soul goes to a higher level of the Garden of Eden. So there are always higher and higher levels. So the soul is going higher and higher. So there are many different levels. And so these souls are going higher and higher. And kamo shemavayeh b'mayma hamuska, as it explains by the way, in brackets, in the original discourse, the lefamim neshama min neshama ne'etzelet. Sometimes one soul comes from another soul. Now that's a very interesting idea, because really the souls of the Jewish people are all bonded together. They are all linked together. So there is a sense in which the entire Jewish people alive today, all their souls are actually connected together. And then there's a further idea, that the souls are connected with those souls which did already live. They've been in the world, and now they've gone to the Garden of Eden. And there may be this level, or that level, or higher. And our souls here in the world are connected with them as well. And then there's a further idea, that we are connected with the souls who have not yet been born. Even those neshamot, those souls, you understand the term soul? Yeah. Those souls which have not yet been born, they are also connected. So there's a sense in which every all these different souls are connected together. Now, it's at this point that we're going to move on to section Bet. And what the basic theme is that the souls, the people, the Jewish people here in this world, when they make some kind of little step of Jewish expression, whatever it is, however imperfect it might be, that's one of the themes that we come to in this discourse. It's not perfect. It could be very imperfect. It is something so tremendous that it stirs the entire cosmos. That all the souls, wherever they are, the souls which are in the Garden of Eden, the souls that haven't been born, all of these souls, they think it's tremendously exciting that us, who are living here in this physical world, we are doing something, some little illumination which relates to Torah and Mitzvah. And it also affects the divine, according to the first explanation, that it means the angels, those are the friends, and God. There's some immense spiritual effect from every tiny little movement that we make of a positive. Well, it's interesting that when the Rambam, Maimonides, who lived 800 years ago, he talks about the immense effect that each person has in every movement that they make. And he starts off with the negative. He says if they make a negative movement, they are changing the balance of the world and of themselves to negative. And if they make a positive movement, they change it to positive. However, when Hasidic teachings repeat these ideas, they tend to focus on the positive. Why? Because according to Hasidic thought, the positive things are real and the negative are unreal. It's like light and darkness. If you say that positive is light and negative is darkness, that's a common image. Now, light is real. Light is electromagnetic energy. You can measure light. Light even has a certain tangible force. Have you ever seen a photometer? Which is inside a little, this is my favorite thing when I was a child, because there was one in an optician shop just near where I live. So that's a glass which has got a vacuum inside it. And then there's a thing like this, actually, four veins. And the way this would be, on one side it's black, and on the other side it's silver. So the light, and this is a vacuum, no air in it, yeah? So the light would hit the silver side, and make it go round, and it would only operate from photons, from the force of light. And if you would hide the light, they would stop. It would stop moving. Then when you take your hand...
Your optometrist had one of these.
There was an optician near where I lived where they had one of these in the window. And I'd read about it in a book on physics. So, like a school textbook. So it was, I always like walking over to this shop and looking at the at this little thing. But what it's saying is that light has a tangible energy. However, darkness is nothing. All darkness is absence of light. There is no energy of darkness. You can't shine darkness. Yes, that would be a new invention, that you have a thing that you switch on and it shines darkness into the room. There's no such thing. You have light or the absence of light. So that's the Hasidic perspective on good and bad. Good is something positive, and bad is an absence of that positive thing. Of course, that absence can be horrific. It can be a very terrible lack of light. But in essence, that is the reality is the good. And so therefore, over the generations, it's the good that accumulates. The bad is something which is in a person's own life, for example. Or if a person's soul has come into the world several times. So all the goodness that we have done in our different incarnations, you understand that? Mm-hmm. The goodness that we've done in our different incarnations, that accumulates. The bad does not accumulate. Because the bad is an absence of good, and it doesn't have the same, it doesn't have the same measure. It's something that we have to work out at that particular time, and that's maybe why we're back in the world, in order to put certain things right. But in, there is actually a positive dimension building up for each person. So that's the, so that's this concept, that when a person is in the world, and he or she does something which is good, it has a tremendous cosmic effect. So let's try and take this a little bit further in chapter 2. There are just...
But there is an accumulation of bad. I mean, if you think of group dynamics, if you think of it like group dynamics, yeah? The moment something's negative, it's much easier to go into the negative again. So in that way, negativity does accumulate.
Well, you're right.
Can't you say in Hasidic terms this is actually, well, I think as Naftali says, negativity, darkness, it doesn't have any energy. What you have is a mixture of good and bad. So it's like the negativity feeds off that goodness that has become inscribed in the negativity. If you were able to draw the goodness, the light out of that, then that group dynamic of negative energy wouldn't exist because you would nullify it.
Yeah, it's possible to. But Tali was saying you can't accumulate negativity. I'm saying negativity can accumulate.
Well, I think
it can if it's mixed up. If it preys off good energy, then like an unpleasant dictatorship, it will. It will accumulate.
Once you do something, it's easier to do it next time.
Yes. Very easy. Yeah. That's very true. So negative pathways can become more easily trodden, and they can become the norm. And so gradually, more and more of the negative can become the norm. And unfortunately, that increases. Negativity in the sense of schar mitzvah, the reward of a good deed is a good deed, and one transgression drags another transgression in its doing one bad thing will drag another bad thing, so one can go lower and lower and lower. However, in terms of the spiritual force, the ultimate spiritual force of good is eternal. And the bad that a person does, in a sense, is waiting to be transformed into good. Because anything bad that a person does is really waiting for the step of tshuva, of repentance. And the step of repentance will take the bad and transform it into good. The sheker, the falsehood, like we had in the other diagram, the falsehood will be transformed into a plank of the temple. So anything which is false is actually waiting in some way to be restructured and redeemed. At the time when you're looking at it, the falsehood can be very, very bad and distressing, and it can be getting more and more as well. And it can become the norm. It can be the norm. It can become the whole society. And yet, that negativity can then be transformed around. This is a very optimistic view.
Yes.
This is a very optimistic view of life, and I think that emunah, that faith, that the negative can become positive, is first of all starting with one's own life. Because one sees negative things. Oh, why did I do that? I was so stupid. I wasted 5 years of my life. There are all kinds of 50 years.
It's all true when it's when you're affecting yourself. Yes. So you can always say, oh, this was at a good purpose. But when you affect other people, then...
Then the good results are not so clear. If there's a negative effect on someone else, God forbid, if you upset another person. So you can't say about the other person, oh, well, it was really good for them. But you can't say that.
Well, it's a very optimistic view.
It is an optimistic view. But the question is in terms of a viewpoint which is effective in getting from one point to another, I think it's the optimistic views which have the power
on an individual level.
Even on a broader level. You know, in order to see the purpose of life for a people and for the world as a whole, you need a certain level of optimism. In order to improve things, you need a level of optimism. The belief that they can be improved. And not only that, but you can improve them.
That's true. As I said, I think that on a personal level...
Yes. On a personal level, it's easier obvious. To see. Yeah, it's obvious.
On a non-personal level, my personal feeling is I'm for the death sentence. Full stop.
Oh, you mean you approve the death sentence?
Yes. On a non-personal, on an interpersonal level. Yeah. But there's no ultimate good purpose that one could wait and say, okay, let's see the good that comes out of this.
Well, sometimes very strong measures are needed in order to change around what a society is doing. You know, that's a different question. That doesn't necessarily cancel this concept of optimism. You can be optimistic about a society and about the people in a society, but you might say it needs to be more firm about what is going on in the society. In different ways. All right, let's try and take this a little bit further. Olahavim shaychut shnei haperushim. To understand these two interpretations, that it's the God is somehow recognizing the power of the soul, the individual, and the other souls are recognizing the power of the individual. Before this, it explains in the original discourse, which he is talking about. That's the discourse which is in this book. Asheker shehanashama yoredet lamatu mitlabeshet beguf. When the soul descends below and is enclosed in the body, hinei avsha aguf u ma'alim u mastir, even though the body hides the soul, mikol makom, nonetheless, al yedei avodah, through the spiritual effort that a person has, meisir ha'elem behester, a person removes the concealment. So we have the idea, to give another image, we have sort of the body of a person, and that means all different aspects of, you know, physical and you know, so psychological life, and within them there is the soul. The soul is within. Now that soul is really something divine which comes from above, from the infinite. So there, the soul is there within the person, and it's an interesting question. Should we put the soul where the heart is or where the head is? But anyway, I'll put it where the heart is. No, it could sometimes be thought of as in the head. So that is the deeper spiritual reality of the person. And it could be that the person's ordinary material life, their material dimension, takes over. And the soul is hidden. You don't see the soul at all. But the power eventually is, the ultimate power, is that one can remove the concealment so the soul shines through. And then, va'adarabah, on the contrary, al yedei yiridah v'hitlapshut zu, through this descent of the soul into the body and being enclosed in the body, humitchazek biyitaron koach, the soul actually gets stronger. Now, this concept of the soul getting stronger because it's in a difficult situation. You see, when the soul is, before it's come into a body, the soul is much more free, it's spiritual. Whereas when it's in a body, it's subject to all the different problems of physical life in this world, and the soul is more limited. But
so isn't it saying here that the guf mitchazek beitaron koach?
No, it's the soul. It's the soul.
It's the masculine and the soul is the feminine.
You're right, and it should probably have said mitchazeket. Yes, I think you're right. But if you see what it says as we go on, it's the soul in relation to the body and the world. And v'hinei diyuk halashon va'adaraba, this expression, on the contrary, that the soul actually gains by being in this difficult situation. You see, the whole purpose of this brief discourse is to explain the positive power of being in the difficult situation of this dark, gloomy world. Remembering also that this discourse was originally said 1951, just a few years after the Holocaust, with a very strong sense, and the person who's saying it, many people in his family were killed, and his brother-in-law and sister-in-law were killed in the Holocaust, and huge, obviously, you know, a third of the Jewish people, and which he felt very, very strongly as a great Jewish leader, and which really was on his consciousness all the time. So in that very dark world, vihine, so he is explaining, what does it mean the soul coming into this world is strengthened? Hu kumo shemavaya Rabbeinu Azaken, as Rabbi Shneur Zalman explains, the words of the Baal Shem Tov, b'inyan hakas, concerning anger. Okay, so here comes a Hasidic teaching on anger. So imagine if someone comes along and does something which makes you angry. How do you respond? The Kabbalists are very opposed to anger. It's interesting that although psychotherapy has a kind of a strong Jewish origin, psychotherapists are very much into anger. You know, they tell people, oh, you've got to learn how to be angry, you don't keep your anger bottled up inside you. I must say, I think that often leads to lots of extra problems. But maybe it's good for business.
Don't we know?
But the Kabbalistic approach to anger and the Hasidic approach to anger is, you see, a certain upsetting thing has happened. You know, you were waiting at the traffic lights in your car, and suddenly, bang, a car at the back has smashed into your car and broken the back of the car. So in England, there's a concept called road rage. I don't know if they have this in Brazil, but in England, there are awful accidents just by people getting very angry about their car. So yeah, okay. So certain things are universal. So the person is furious. Why did this idiot bang into my car behind? Couldn't he see the traffic lights are red? What's the matter with him? I'm sure he was talking on his mobile phone. So the Kabbalistic view would be,
go on. This is a good thing. Well, me, from a practical point of view, I claimed on the insurance and I fixed the whole car.
Well, let's take it a step earlier. Who banged into the car? Who decided that the car should be banged into?
Hashem,
God. It's God acting through the other guy.
Well, this is a kavua val a reshut nitenet. It's a reshut that the person took.
He's, what that means is everything is decided by God, but there is free will. You see, God decided someone's going to bang into the back of my car. Should it be this person? It doesn't have to be. No, he's going to drive very carefully today. So it'll be another person. But that it's going to happen to my car, or maybe I'll back into a lamppost. But it's going to happen to my car. That's what's kavur. How it's going to happen, that's the reshut.
Or maybe what is kavur that people do bang into the back of other people's cars. And the victim and the perpetrator are not...
Well, the way it's explained in Tanya is that the victim is fixed. That's God's decision. The victim is going to have the back of his car banged into, and who is going to do it?
That's
to a certain extent free. Like it says about Nero, the Emperor Nero, who has a bad press in Latin history, but a better one in the Talmud. He was advancing on Jerusalem, and as an oracle, he's had someone shoot an arrow in the air and to see which way the arrow landed. And the arrow landed facing Jerusalem. And then he did it again, and again the arrow landed facing Jerusalem. And he did it again, and again the arrow landed facing Jerusalem. So if he was a normal Roman, he would have said, good, the gods are with me, I'm going to go and attack Jerusalem. He didn't. He said, the God of the Jews wants to destroy his city, and he wants me to be the idiot who does it. I'm not going to do it. And he ran away.
And he didn't.
He didn't.
Did he convert then?
Yeah, the story in the Talmud is that Nero converted to Judaism.
Where?
And went to live in Asia somewhere.
Where is this story?
I can't remember where, but you can do a... Have you got the Talmud digitally? If you do a search, Neron.
Neron?
Yeah, that's his name. In Neron Kaiser. It's... Or do it just on Google, you'll find it. Nero converts, you know, to Judaism. Nero Judaism. You'll get some talk
this
about it.
This changes the whole picture of Nero.
Yes, it does. Yeah. So there is the idea that the Baal Shem Tov said about kas, about anger, that if there is someone standing who is trying while a person is praying and trying to confuse you, you just think, you know what, he doesn't put it as a car banging into you. He said, you're praying, you're trying to pray to God, and someone is trying to confuse you, is shouting at you. Could be a non-Jew who is making a noise or insulting you in some way, you just say the elo od yoter shepoel bo chizuk v'tosfot koach. This strengthens the person and gives them more energy. Kishemitbonen in yan galut hashchina, he thinks about the exile of the divine presence, which has come down into the words of this person trying to confuse him. So that means that through the negative thing, there is actually a something positive. And we have this now as an explanation of this week's Sedra. This week's Sedra is B'Shalach, and it talks about Pharaoh chasing the Jewish people. And so it says here, Vayihi B'Shalach Paro et Ha'am. It was when Paro sent the Jewish people away. The Hakavana B'Zeh, who the Lord Zubilvad Shelo Helim Behistir Klipat Paro. It's not only that the negativity of Pharaoh didn't hide, Adarabba Od Siyer, he helped. Pharaoh actually helped the Jewish people. There's another verse in our Sedra this week. Ufaro hikriv. Now hikriv means made people drew near. Ve'ita b'midrash hikriv et liban shel Yisrael la'avim shebashamayim. Pharaoh drew near the hearts of the Jewish people to their Father in heaven. In other words, you have something negative causing something positive.
Can I ask you, can you please explain what the comment B, bet, is, below the text?
This is talking about what is the word arel, mm-hmm. And talking about the text in Tanya, right? So arel is a word meaning a non-Jew, meaning uncircumcised, right? Now in Tanya, it says, this is the correct reading in Tanya at the end of chapter 28, but because of the censor. The end of chapter 28. But because of the censor, it didn't write non-Jew, it wrote idolater, oved gelulim, one who serves idols. So the censor would say, what's this about a non-Jew? In the Tanya, and then they would have to answer the censor. The censor might want to cross it out, so they wrote idolater. So because of writing idolater, that got through the censor without any problem, because all Hebrew books in the 18th, 19th century were censored in Russia. At the end, after 1928, I think it was, certainly after 1935. They censored everything so heavily it was almost impossible to print a book in Russia.
And Oved Gelulim was acceptable.
Yeah, because they said,
Arel wasn't acceptable.
No, that's right. Yeah. And so then he compares the text in chapter 28 to another section of Tanya in Igeret HaKodesh, the fourth section of Tanya. So it's like discussing what is the correct reading. So that's how that. So there you have the idea that the negative actually causes something positive. Okay, so let's now just go on to the last page, penultimate page, section Gimel. V'zeu inyan dahayoshevet beganim, and that's what it means, the ones who are sitting in the gardens. Hanashamot, the souls. Hayoshvot began Eden atachton, who are sitting in the lower garden of Eden, and the upper over Gan Eden Elyon, and in the upper garden of Eden. Ba'im lahakshiv kolam, they come to hear the voice, the neshamat Yisrael, the mata, of the Jewish souls below. The Hakavanah Bezer is the meaning of this is the Gama Neshamot Kamo Shehem Lemaila Kodim Yiridatam Beguf. That means the souls as they are above before they descend in the body. V'gam otan neshamat shekva hayu beguf, and also those souls who already had, who had been in a body, and so they have been in a body, and they're now on a higher level of the Garden of Eden. They now come to hear the soul, to hear the souls who are here in this world. If we come to Ubecholze, so in other words, they've reached various levels of perfection. Ubecholze, that's 3, 3, 6, 9 lines down, I think. You got it, Ellie?
Yeah.
Ubecholze, nonetheless, even though they are so exalted, the souls who've been in this world, hinegam hem ba'im, they come to listen to the voices of the souls which are enclosed in bodies. Va'afilu im avodatam eina adayin b'shleimut, even if the service of the souls in the bodies in this world are not whole, they are not the way they're supposed to be, nonetheless, these other souls come to see them and come to hear them. And the various ways in which they might be imperfect, perfection, you know, dedication, there are all kinds of tremendous levels of possibility. From these great levels of possibility, of spiritual possibility, Nitapech, we're skipping a few lines. Nitapach, mikesha v'sheker, sheker olam, it changes from the kesha, meaning a plot, a negative plot. Sheker, falsehood, the falsehood of the world, becomes a keresh, becomes a plank of the sanctuary. Atzei shitim omdim, the pillars of wood which stand up, ומחברים אור אינסוף ברוך הוא עם העולם, and they join the radiance of the infinite with the world. התהפכה, a transformation מן הקצה לקצה, from one extreme to the other. So there is this transformation which is taking place. Now, that's possible, but even when it doesn't happen, when it's imperfect, and the soul below hasn't really achieved this, or it's only just trying to, a little bit, there's some little step. Nonetheless, it is a cosmic effect that the soul has in the world. And if we go down, kulam bayim lahakshiv lekabel kolam shel neshamot, all of these different spiritual dimensions, souls, angels, whatever it is, to hear the voice of the souls, mlubashim begufim, which are there in bodies. Va'av she'adayin lo ishlimu avodatam, even though they have not yet perfected their service. Ki av she'hem nefutzim bagola, even though they are scattered in exile. V'ro'im beganim shel achelim, and they're wandering in other people's gardens. V'chol zeh, nonetheless, reißt man sich ab von Welt, they tear themselves away from the world. And they take with their body, their animal soul. They come into a synagogue or a study house or a shir to study somewhere. They say the Shema. They do something. They study Torah. There's some little step they do. They order a kosher meal instead of a non-kosher meal. Shezeu inyan mesirut nefesh mamash, that is really a kind of self-sacrifice, because it's doing something right out of the ordinary. Undos famokt mano in olam hazeh, you can achieve this step of self-transcendence, this step of sacred folly, you can only do in this world, in this physical world. Then the changing of the sheker, of the falsehood to the plank, or the sacred folly which transforms the ordinary folly, that can only be in this world. V'lachein, and therefore, hachaverim, the souls in the Garden of Eden who listen to their voice, and also God and his angels, his familia, they come and trying to find the last page. They come, Baim Lishmoa Bekolech, they come to hear your voice. And even though this is an imperfect, very often imperfect situation, nonetheless, they draw down from higher than Hishtalshalut, that means from an exalted spiritual level above, drawing down into this world, Sheyeh Hashem Echad, Ushmo Echad, that it should be God is one and His name is one. So that is now I'm told that when the Rebbe said this discourse, when the Lubavitcher Rebbe said this discourse in 1951, he was weeping almost the whole time because he found it so moving. I think first of all the connection of souls together, and also the idea that when a Jew makes some tiny little step forward, it has such tremendous spiritual significance. And that moved the Rebbe very much, and he wept a lot during his saying of this talk. And then it was printed a couple of months later, this brief little talk. Yeah.